exploited by the business community. When employers report that there's no one in the country able to do the jobs they want filled, and that they need to bring in foreign labor, what is really going on is that there's no one here willing to do the job for the low wages being offered. Too often, guest worker programs are used not to help employers hire labor they couldn't find locally, but to drive down wages with cheap labor from abroad. Instead of a rising tide lifting all boats, it is a leaky boat sinking slowly to the bottom. But it gets worse. The Southern Poverty Law Center and the AFL-CIO have documented many cases of employers cheating guest workers out of wages, seizing their passports, forcing them to live in substandard conditions, and even denying them medical treatment for on-the-job injuries. Guest workers will understandably hesitate before complaining, because while they are here legally, their temporary visa is tied to a specific company. Their fate is effectively controlled by their employer, no less than the Kentucky coal miner in Merle Travis's song 16 Tons, who pretty near owes his soul to the company store. There's a lot of discussion and demagoguery regarding illegal immigration. There is too little discussion and legislative action regarding how corporate America and the business community exploit and benefit from the labor of undocumented workers. When we talk about the flood of undocumented people who have come into the United States, we must consider the impact of American policy, especially trade policy and the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA. When NAFTA was passed, its proponents said that liberalized trade with Mexico would increase the standard of living in that country and thus reduce the flow of undocumented immigrants into the United States. In fact, the exact opposite happened. After NAFTA went into effect in 1994, inexpensive and highly subsidized American corn exports to Mexico increased fivefold, flooding the Mexican market and pushing hundreds of thousands of farmers off their lands. Pork imports rose 25-fold, eliminating 120,000 Mexican jobs. The number of Mexicans living in extreme poverty surged by more than 14 million, and the number of Mexicans entering the U.S. without authorization increased by 185% between 1992 and 2011. Free trade didn't stem illegal immigration. It accelerated it. The nexus between free trade, illegal immigration, and exploitation of undocumented workers was chronicled by David Bacon in a 2012 article in The Nation. He recounts the plight of several Mexican farmers and butchers who lost their jobs when U.S. pork flooded the Mexican market after NAFTA. In desperation, they all left their families behind, crossed the border illegally, and carefully made their way to the town of Tar Heel, North Carolina. There, they got under-the-table jobs at the world's largest meat processing facility owned by Smithfield, where half of the plant's workers were Hispanic immigrants. Little did they know that their cheap labor was padding the bottom line of the very company that had flooded Mexico with the inexpensive pork that led to the loss of their livelihoods in the first place. You just can't make this stuff up. In 2005, Human Rights Watch called out Smithfield's Tar Heel plant for a whole slew of unsafe working conditions. Plant managers seemed indifferent to safety problems, even though worker injuries, many gruesome and some even fatal, were common. And then again, they didn't have to worry. Undocumented workers have no rights, and they'll think long and hard before complaining or even seeking medical care, because by doing either, they risk losing their jobs or being deported. Proponents of the Central America Free Trade Act, CAFTA, which expanded NAFTA to five Central American nations, similarly argued that the 2004 agreement would stem illegal immigration. But prolonged economic instability some of the worst gang violence in the world, and widespread drug trafficking in Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras have sent a surge of undocumented immigrants to the U.S. since 2014. This includes previously unheard-of numbers of mothers with young children and unaccompanied minors sent by their parents on a perilous trip north in search of safety. These refugees are fleeing horrific violence in their home countries, and many suffer kidnapping, extortion, human trafficking, and rape as they travel through Mexico. It is deeply distressing to me that so many voices in our country blithely insist that these desperate people, mostly women and young children, should be sent back to the countries they fled. What horrors will they face if they are forced to return? As a civilized nation, we have a moral obligation to make sure these families and children are humanely cared for while in U.S. custody, but sadly, that is not always the case. The three family detention centers opened since 2014 are overcrowded and lack proper medical facilities. Detainees are treated as criminals, sometimes being woken up every 15 minutes at night. There have been documented cases of prisoner abuse, including rape. Almost half of all unaccompanied children in custody do not even have a lawyer while in deportation proceedings. To my mind, the U.S. government should not be in the painful and inhumane business of locking up families who have fled violence. We must put an end to family detention and treat these families with the compassion and dignity they deserve. That is why I called on President Obama to extend temporary protected status for families who fled violence in Central America. And that is why in April 2016, I proudly stood with immigration activists in Reading, Pennsylvania, including actress Rosario Dawson, Mayor Valentin Rodriguez of West Reading, and Adan Jesus Marin of Working Families PA, to call for the closing of the Berks County Family Detention Center. As I write, several mothers with young children at the Berks Center are on a hunger strike, protesting living conditions and cursory asylum hearings. Many are waiting to be deported and are terrified about the future that awaits them and their children. And while Berks is a government-run facility, the other two family detention centers, both located in Texas, are operated by private companies. They are making a profit off the anguish of asylum seekers paid for with taxpayer money. This is so profoundly wrong, as my good friend and colleague Representative Raul Grijalva noted. Allowing corporations to profit by locking up desperate adults and children undermines our decency as a nation. America has always been a haven for the oppressed. We cannot and must not shirk our historic role as a protector of vulnerable people fleeing persecution. We must, as President Lincoln urged in his first inaugural address, appeal to the better angels of our nature. We must treat others as we would like to be treated. Sadly, in 2016, we had a major party candidate for president spending endless hours doing the exact opposite, appealing to our worst human traits, bigotry and racism. It is way past time to stop peddling hatred for political gain. We need real solutions to the real problems facing our country, including immigration. We cannot, should not, and will not sweep up 11 million people and throw them out of the country. Tearing apart families and disrupting whole communities is not only inhumane, it isn't close to being feasible. Can you imagine the size and cost of the deportation force that would be needed to track down and arrest and process 11 million people? Or the number of prison cells needed to temporarily house them? Or the number of planes or buses needed to deport them? Not to mention the incredible economic dislocation that action would have. Really, the whole idea is beyond absurd. We need to get serious. We need comprehensive immigration reform. and for a short while in 2013, it looked like we might make some real progress. After considerable debate, the Senate passed an immigration reform bill that would have given legal status to millions of aspiring Americans. As with any complicated legislation, there are aspects of that bill that I strongly supported and parts I disagreed with. However, while far from perfect, this legislation was an important step toward addressing the immigration crisis facing our country, and I was proud to vote for it. Unfortunately, after the Senate passed the bill, the Republican-controlled House of Representatives failed to take it up, killing any hope for its passage. The right-wing extremists in the Republican Party prevailed. They preferred to have a politically charged wedge issue to use to divide the country than to forge a real solution to a major American problem. While Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell refused to reconsider immigration reform in the 2015 session, he did find time to debate a proposal by Pennsylvania Republican Senator Pat Toomey to deny federal economic development assistance to sanctuary cities, where police and other public agencies do not inquire into a person's immigration status during routine business. After all, feeding into concerns about public safety to gin up the Republican base pays far greater political dividends than actually taking meaningful action on immigration reform. Congress won't even pass the DREAM Act, which offers permanent residency to young people without criminal records if they serve in our armed forces or attend college. Is this not what we want from our youth? To be upstanding citizens, contribute to the national defense, and learn skills to strengthen our economy? Apparently, that's not the Republican perspective. In light of congressional inaction, President Obama was absolutely right to issue a series of executive orders in November 2014 to accomplish some of what Congress has failed to do. While I would have much preferred that Congress, rather than the President, address our broken immigration system, the sad truth is that Congress has not acted. President Obama's executive orders would allow approximately 4 million undocumented immigrants to stay in the U.S. without fear of deportation. One order expanded the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, DACA, program to include more people and extend the DACA work authorization period from 2 years to 3 years. A second order made it easier for the parents of U.S. citizens and lawful permanent residents to stay in the country. And a third extended the same relief to spouses and children of U.S. citizens and lawful permanent residents. Beneficiaries of all three orders had to pass strict background checks before being granted relief to stay in this country. I guess it should come as no surprise that a group of Republicans challenged the executive order in court, saying that the president exceeded his constitutional authority. Of course, Obama only resorted to issuing the orders after Congress refused to do its job. Let's pass comprehensive immigration reform. The incoming Congress must do its job and pass what the majority of Americans demand, a comprehensive and humane immigration reform policy. Let me outline what I think that means. First and foremost, it means creating a path for the 11 million undocumented people in our country to become lawful permanent residents and eventually citizens. It is time to bring these people out of the shadows and give them the full protection of the law. They should be allowed to improve their lives while contributing more fully and fairly to the American economy, including paying their fair share of income, Social Security, and Medicare taxes. The path to citizenship must be fair in terms of not having overly restrictive eligibility dates and application periods. Financial penalties and fees must likewise be fair. They cannot be so onerous as to be an obstacle for attaining legal residency. Immigration reform must include the DREAM Act, the granting of conditional residency to people who serve in the military or attend college. It's time to tap the potential of all of our youth. Immigration reform must allow individuals to apply for relief even if convicted for nonviolent offenses. A prior nonviolent conviction, like the 17-year-old DUI charge that led to last year's deportation of Iowa City pastor Max Viatoro, shouldn't automatically disqualify someone from legal residency. Done correctly, immigration reform will allow the authorities to appropriately focus on violent offenders instead of hard-working people who want to get right with the law. Immigration reform must eliminate the 3-year, 10-year, and permanent bars. Every year, thousands of people leave the country to normalize their immigration status, which, depending on the circumstances, sometimes has to be done outside the country. However, once outside, they realize that they are barred from reentering for 3 or 10 years, or in some cases permanently, because they were previously here illegally. It makes no sense to bar people, some of whom have been living here for many years, from reentering only to allow them back in years later. Let's eliminate this catch-22 many people face when legally applying for a green card. Immigration reform means ending arbitrary family deportation sweeps, and it means expanding the use of humanitarian parole for unjustly deported immigrants to hasten the reunification of broken families. Immigration reform means immediately ending family detention, and it means promoting alternatives to individual detention, which would allow thousands of nonviolent detainees to reunite with their families as they wait for their day in court. A good start would be getting rid of the requirement that Immigration and Customs Enforcement maintain a level of 34,000 detention beds. Eliminating the costly and harmful bed quota would allow ICE to use alternatives to detention that could save taxpayers $5 million per day, or $1.4 billion per year. Immigration reform means ending for-profit, privately run immigration detention facilities. In September 2015, I introduced the Justice Is Not For Sale Act with Reps Raul Grijalva, Keith Ellison, and Bobby Rush to ban all private prisons, including immigrant detention centers. I was very pleased when in August the Department of Justice said it would phase out the use of private prisons. Just 2 weeks later, Department of Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson announced that the DHS might follow suit. We must keep up the pressure to make sure this happens. Immigration reform means significantly improving conditions inside public-run detention facilities, especially for vulnerable populations, including pregnant women, unaccompanied minors, LGBT individuals, and detainees with disabilities. Immigration reform means making sure all detained immigrants always have access to legal counsel before and during hearings to ensure due process and equal protection, and it means providing adequate funding to eliminate the backlog in immigration courts and restoring judicial discretion to allow immigration judges to consider the unique circumstances of each case. Immigration reform must focus on cracking down on unscrupulous employers that exploit undocumented workers, rather than penalizing workers. And it should establish a whistleblower visa for undocumented workers who report labor violations to protect those who currently don't report infractions for fear of deportation, and to hold accountable employers that currently abuse workers with impunity. Immigration reform must include tough measures to prevent employers from exploiting temporary guest workers, especially those on H-2B, H-1B, and J-1 visas. Binding workers to a specific employer or not allowing their family members to work creates a situation ripe for abuse and exacerbates an already unequal relationship between the employer and the employee. We can't continue to let this go unchecked. Immigration reform means making sure our borders are modern and secure, especially in this era of non-state terrorism. Rather than building walls, we must target construction wisely and invest smartly in high-tech equipment and state-of-the-art cameras. We must avoid the over-militarization of our border communities and work more closely with local residents and law enforcement. Immigration reform must create viable and legal channels that match our labor market's needs and that promote family cohesion. Family-based visas are at the center of a humane immigration system, which recognizes that workers with families nearby are healthier and more productive, and that their families, particularly children, benefit immensely as well. Prioritizing the unity of families is a time-tested American value. In light of a historic refugee crisis, immigration reform means reaffirming our commitment to accepting our fair share of refugees. At a time when millions of people have fled unspeakable violence with nothing but the shirts on their backs, we must do our parts to offer safe refuge, and we must make a special effort to enhance protections for survivors of gender-based violence and human trafficking. Until we achieve a single-payer healthcare system, all immigrants, including undocumented workers and their families, should be able to purchase insurance through Affordable Care Act exchanges. Aspiring Americans represent a large portion of the remaining uninsured in our country, and allowing them to purchase health insurance with their own money is good for them and will reduce overall healthcare costs. And lastly, immigration reform means recognizing that inequality across the world is a major driving force behind migration. The truth is, our free trade policies are exacerbating inequality by devastating local economies, pushing millions to migrate. We must rewrite our trade policies to end the race to the bottom and instead work to lift the living standard of Americans and people throughout the world. These are just some of the major aspects of what I think immigration reform means. There are certainly others, but what should never get lost in the wonky details of immigration policy is that we're talking about people. We're talking about families. During the campaign, I visited Friendship Park in San Diego, California. Located right on the Pacific Ocean, it's a beautiful location. It's also a very sad location, because it is the place where, every Saturday and Sunday, from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., the U.S. Border Patrol opens a gate, allowing visitors to approach an 18-foot-high, tightly woven steel fence that marks the border between San Diego and Tijuana. Here, in Friendship Park, family members on one side of the border come to meet family members from the other side. They cannot hug or kiss, but they can stick a thin finger, perhaps a pinky, through the fence to have some minimal physical contact with their loved ones. While many people visiting the fence smile and laugh, many others weep. It occurred to me that Friendship Park is a metaphor for our broken immigration system and the challenges before us. Fundamentally, we need immigration policies that bring families together, not policies that divide them. With strong moral leadership, I believe we can move our nation toward common sense, humane, and comprehensive immigration reform. And by doing that, we can reverse the decline of our middle class, better prepare the United States to compete in the global economy, and build upon the best parts of our national tradition of embracing diversity and difference and harnessing them for the common good. 9. Protecting our most vulnerable. A great nation is judged not by how many millionaires and billionaires it has, or by the size of its military budget. It is not judged by the greed of its largest corporations. It is judged by how well it treats its weakest and most vulnerable citizens. A truly great nation is one that is filled with compassion and solidarity. The United States of America is the richest country in the history of the world. We are a nation of extraordinary wealth. There are now over 10 times as many billionaires in this country as there were just 16 years ago. We have, by far, the highest level of income and wealth inequality of any major country, and the gap between the very rich and everyone else is growing wider and wider. If we were to judge a nation simply by how many millionaires and billionaires it has, America would be number one, bar none. But that's not how we should judge a nation. As President Franklin Delano Roosevelt reminded us, the test of our progress is not whether we add more to the abundance of those who have much, it is whether we provide enough for those who have little. By that measure, we're not number one. In fact, the United States lags behind virtually every other major country on earth in terms of our social safety net and in how well we provide for the weak and the vulnerable. In America today, 43.1 million people are living in poverty, 13.5% of our entire population. The poverty rate is higher today than it was in 1968, and that is the official poverty rate, which is based on a formula developed more than 50 years ago that doesn't take into account the cost of childcare or work-related expenses. If the poverty threshold were set to reflect the actual costs of getting by in this country, a lot more people would be considered to be living in poverty, millions more. Let's be clear about what living in poverty means. For a household of three people, the official poverty threshold is $18,871. Do you have any idea how hard it is for a family to live on $18,871? Many low-income families spend at least half their incomes on housing. For them, that means about $9,000 a year remain for everything else: food, clothing, transportation, childcare, utilities, healthcare, medicine, a Christmas gift for your kid. In today's world, a computer, broadband, and cell phone are increasingly becoming a necessity of life. How do you find a job, make appointments for interviews, or connect to the world without a phone? Can you keep a job if your employer can't get a hold of you? And all that stuff is pretty expensive. If you're in a rural area, you most likely need a car to go to work. Old cars break down, and it's often expensive to fix them, not to mention the other costs of having a car: registration, insurance, inspection, and the cost of a driver's license. Oh yes, cars run on gas, and you have to fill the gas tank to get to work. Or if you're in an urban area, the cost of a bus or a train is not inexpensive. In terms of the cost of food, it's likely that if you live in a low-income neighborhood, you pay more for lower-quality food than middle-class people do, because there may not be a decent supermarket in your neighborhood. Probably not a bank either, and you may have to pay a substantial sum to get a check cashed. I remember being at a meeting with clergymen in Baltimore who were telling me that being poor is a very expensive proposition. And they were right. There's no question that government programs like food stamps, Medicaid, the earned income tax credit, and subsidized housing help, but not enough. The truth is that being poor in America is enormously dispiriting and stressful. And what is perhaps most disturbing, under 18s are the age group with the highest poverty rate. Fully 19.7% of American children are living in poverty, which gives the United States the distinction of having the highest child poverty rate of almost any major country on earth. How can it be that in a country with $88 trillion in wealth, we allow one in five children to live in poverty? How can it be that in our great country, since the Great Recession of 2008, the number of homeless children in our public schools has doubled, now numbering nearly 1.4 million homeless kids drifting from school to school as their parents try to find temporary housing in which to live? At a town hall meeting I held in West Virginia's McDowell County, one of the poorest counties in the nation, an elementary school teacher there by the name of Tanya Spinella spoke with eloquence on this subject. Here's what she said. Our students have an intellect, a drive, and a thirst for knowledge, just as any burgeoning young minds across the nation do. Our students, however, have something else. In many cases, they're born into crippling poverty, broken or untraditional family structures, or are, worst yet, born into families with severe and debilitating drug addictions? How can we expect our students to remember their homework or to bring a pencil to class if they've been up crying all night because they have a cavity they cannot treat? How can we expect them to learn multiplication when all they can think about is the ever-present threat of eviction after a parent loses their job? How can we expect them to succeed in life when all they've ever been told is that they cannot succeed because they are from McDowell County? Tanya's right, and we should be grateful for the enormously important work that she does with her students. But it's not just McDowell County, West Virginia. I heard the same message in the Bronx, in Texas, in Arizona, and in Baltimore. I heard it all across the country. I heard it as it applies to white kids, black kids, Latino kids, Native American kids, and Asian American kids. How can it be that we have enough money to give tax breaks to billionaires and spend more on defense than the next 7 countries combined, but we don't have enough to make sure that every American child has a roof over his or her head and enough food to eat? In New York City, I visited with residents in high-rise public housing projects in Brooklyn and the Bronx, at a time when parents there are desperately trying to keep their kids away from drugs and gangs. I saw a community center that was shut down and locked up because of a lack of funds. No mentoring or after-school recreational programs for the children there. I was told by the members of the city council and state legislature who accompanied me about a $17 billion maintenance and construction backlog in housing projects all across the city. Walls are crumbling, elevators aren't working, and old people can't climb the stairs to go shopping. People are getting sick from mold in the walls. In May of 2016, I campaigned in Puerto Rico and visited San Juan. The people who live in Puerto Rico, American citizens, are not eligible to vote for President of the United States. They are, however, able to participate in the Democratic presidential primary. It is not widely known in the rest of the United States, but Puerto Rico, a U.S. Commonwealth, has been in a severe depression for over a decade. Unemployment on the island is more than twice the U.S. average, and almost 60% of children live in poverty. A bankrupt government has been shutting down schools and healthcare facilities and laying off thousands of workers. There are fierce divisions there about the political future of the island. Some Puerto Ricans want statehood, others want Puerto Rico to become an independent nation, while others want changes to the current system. Yet, in the midst of all the squalor and economic pain, I saw extraordinary determination in a remarkable Montessori school sustained by dedicated teachers and parents in one of the poorest neighborhoods in San Juan. The students there, speaking fluent English, participated in a town meeting we held at the school. I also visited a tenant-run community housing land trust formed to improve the ramshackle homes and community infrastructure, where people have lived for decades along the polluted Martin Peña Channel. This community, which is overrun by raw sewage during heavy rains, has long been ignored by the island government and by our national government. As a nation, our priorities have become horribly distorted. Congress listens to lobbyists from wealthy and powerful corporate interests and ignores the pain of children who are hungry and homeless. The corporate media spends a lot of time covering the lifestyles of the rich and famous, but not all that much time covering the poor and the desperate. To a large degree, these people, the millions of poor people in America, are invisible, living under the radar screen. Their suffering is not seen on our evening news, but it's there. We have already seen how the link between poverty and poor health impacts African Americans and other minorities. It affects poor whites, too. A June 2016 study by the Hamilton Project found that between 1999 and 2014, mortality rates for poor, middle-aged whites rose by about 10%. That is an extraordinary and frightening development. According to those who have studied the issue, the main causes of the decline in longevity among working-class whites are drug and alcohol abuse and suicide. Early deaths among young white Americans are rising as well. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, reported that over the last 15 years, there has been a nearly 30% increase in the death rate among whites between the ages of 25 and 34, driven primarily by drug and alcohol overdoses, suicide, and chronic liver disease. Unable to find decent jobs and decent incomes, living in despair, they're wrecking their lives and dying younger than their parents. Tragically, when people do not have enough income to support their families, when they live under enormous financial stress and have little hope for the future, when they see their lives and the lives of their children moving in exactly the wrong direction, too many turn to drugs and alcohol to numb the pain, and the downward spiral accelerates. Some then turn to suicide. For decades, in the United States and around the world, most countries have seen an increase in life expectancy. And yet now, in the United States, we are seeing millions of Americans, working-class white people, living shorter lives than their parents. Life expectancy for too many Americans is going down when it should be going up. Today in America, poverty is truly a death sentence. There is a growing divide between those who can afford to keep themselves healthy and those who are dying because they are poor. Incredibly, the gap in life expectancy between the very richest Americans and the very poorest Americans is 15 years for men and 10 years for women. A car trip between McDowell County, West Virginia, and Fairfax County, Virginia, takes about 6 hours. But these two counties live in different worlds. McDowell County is one of the poorest counties in America, and Fairfax County is one of the wealthiest. As the New York Times reported, residents of Fairfax County are among the longest lived in the country. Men have an average life expectancy of 82 years and women 85, about the same as in Sweden. In McDowell, the averages are 64 and 73, about the same as Iraq. A few years ago, we had 4 cases of Ebola in America, a frightening disease, to be sure, and the country almost came to a halt. 4 cases, no deaths. But it dominated the airwaves for weeks. The entire public health apparatus was mobilized, and the American people and their leaders were very, very concerned. In 2011, the American Journal of Public Health found that 130,000 people die each year and every year as a result of poverty. But no one seems to notice or care. Or, as Pope Francis said more succinctly, how can it be that it is not a news item when an elderly homeless person dies of exposure, but it is news when the stock market loses 2 points? In January 2016, I held a town meeting with 200 people in Iowa Falls, Iowa, a typical small town in rural America. I asked those who attended a very simple question. How are they doing economically, and had their lives improved since the Great Recession? I believed then, and I believe now, that if we do not know the reality of what is going on in our country in terms of the struggles people are facing, it will be impossible for us to develop and generate public support for policies that can enable us to go forward and address the great challenges we face. So I asked the people of Iowa Falls about their struggles, and this is what they told me. A diabetic man told me he could not afford the insulin that was prescribed to him by his doctor. Another man struggling with diabetes said the price for his medication had skyrocketed from just $3.25 a month to more than $600. A retired worker said that she was struggling to get by on just $10,000 a year because the plastics company she worked for didn't offer her a pension. Then I asked the audience how people in Iowa could get by on just $10,000 or $12,000 a year. There was an awkward pause. I wasn't sure if anyone would speak up. And then, in an extremely moving moment, we heard from Carrie Aldrich. Carrie is a 46-year-old single mom from Alden, Iowa. With tears in her eyes, this is what she said. I've been living on probably less than $12,000 for a long time because of disabilities. It's so hard to do anything to pay your bills. You're ashamed all the time. When you can't buy presents for your kids, it's really, really, really hard. And I work 3, 4, 5 jobs sometimes, always minimum wage. I have a degree, divorced, and it's just I'm waiting for disability to come through so my parents have to support me. It's just hard. What Carrie did took tremendous courage. It's not easy to stand up in a crowded room with national television cameras rolling to talk about what life is like to raise a family with a disability trying to live on less than $12,000. And the truth is that Carrie's not alone. There are millions of others just like her. There are frail senior citizens on fixed incomes who are forced to cut their pills in half because they can't afford the outrageously high costs of medicine they need. There are disabled veterans who bravely fought to defend our country but are now living on the streets as we consistently shortchange the Department of Veterans Affairs. There are workers in their late 50s who worked for the same employer for 30 years and now find themselves unemployed and unemployable because their jobs have been shipped to China or Mexico. There are more than half of our older workers who have no retirement savings and no idea as to how they will ever be able to retire with any shred of dignity or security. There are babies born to mothers who have not completed high school who are almost twice as likely to die before their first birthday as babies born to college graduates. We can no longer continue to ignore the tremendous economic pain and anxiety that exists in our country today. These problems will not go away by sweeping them under the rug. We've got to address them forthrightly, or they will only get worse. We can no longer continue to scapegoat the poor and the unemployed. We've got to create jobs, raise wages, and protect the weak and the vulnerable. Instead of turning the middle class against those most in pain, we need to develop a sense of solidarity and stand together against wealthy special interests who get richer and richer while most everybody else gets poorer. And we cannot allow Republicans to make these problems even worse by cutting Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, veterans benefits, education, public housing, and nutrition programs while giving huge tax breaks to those who need them least. Protecting senior citizens. When people become old, they often become frail and sick. They are unable to work and earn an income. In a civilized society, the older generation, the people who raised us, are entitled and allowed to live out their remaining years in dignity and security. For millions of seniors in our country today, that is most certainly not the case. We must change that. Social Security is the most successful government program in our nation's history. Before Social Security was signed into law, nearly half our senior citizens lived in poverty. Today, while still much too high, the elderly poverty rate is 8.8%. Yet for decades, Republicans have tried to convince the American people that Social Security is in crisis. They say it's going broke, that it won't be there for our kids and grandchildren, that it's a Ponzi scheme, that it is contributing to the deficit. All of that is nonsense. Through good economic times and bad, Social Security has paid every nickel owed to every eligible American, on time and without delay. Today, 59 million seniors, people with disabilities, and children receive benefits from Social Security. Social Security is financially self-sufficient, funded by the payroll tax. Far from being broke, the Social Security Retirement Trust Fund has a $2.8 trillion surplus. And not only hasn't Social Security added a dime to the deficit, it is forbidden by law from doing so. The wars in Iraq and Afghanistan that the Republicans forgot to pay for added trillions to the deficit and national debt, but Social Security didn't. So why are Republicans always trying to undermine public trust in Social Security? For some, it's ideological. They hate that Social Security is a government program that works very well and is extremely popular with the public. it threatens their bedrock philosophy that government can do no good. For others, privatization of Social Security would be a fantastic new opportunity for their friends and campaign contributors on Wall Street to make huge profits by gambling with the retirement savings of working people. Despite what you may have heard on TV, Social Security is not in crisis and is not going broke. The Social Security Retirement Trust Fund can pay full benefits to every single retiree for the next 18 years and 3/4 of benefits afterward. Why not longer? For one thing. Wages for the vast majority of American workers are stagnating, making payroll tax receipts lower than they would be if wages were rising. If we had the same level of economic equality we had in 1983, the retirement trust fund would have another $1.1 trillion on hand and another 20 more years of solvency. Yes, income inequality is a problem for Social Security, too. Moreover, payroll taxes are only assessed on the first $118,500 of income. That means a Wall Street CEO who makes $20 million per year pays no more in payroll taxes than someone earning $118,500. That is an extremely regressive approach. America doesn't have a problem with greedy geezers, to quote one Social Security adversary. It has a problem with the super rich not paying their fair share into the system. About 1 out of 5 senior citizens today are trying to make ends meet on incomes of less than $13,000 a year. Frankly, I don't know how they do it. And the truth is that many of them don't do it. Many of them don't take the medicine they should. Their homes are too cold. They don't get the nutrition they should. That is why we should lift the cap and apply the payroll tax to earned and investment income above $250,000. This would raise taxes only on the wealthiest 1.5% of Americans. In other words, 98.5% of the American people, including those earning between $118,500 and $250,000, would not see their payroll taxes go up one dime. Not only would this simple fix extend Social Security's solvency until at least 2074, it would also provide enough new revenue to expand benefits for seniors making less than $16,000 by $1,300 a year. I think this is a sensible, practical, and fair approach. It asks those who have benefited the most from years of tax cuts and who have the means to pay their fair share of payroll taxes. Today, the average Social Security benefit for retired workers is just $1,341 a month. More than 1/3 of senior citizens depend on Social Security for almost all their income. During 3 out of the last 6 years, despite the skyrocketing cost of prescription drugs, senior citizens and disabled veterans did not receive a cost of living adjustment to keep up with inflation. The number of hungry senior citizens is projected to go up by 50% by 2025. And many of them are already on waiting lists for the Meals on Wheels program, putting them at greater risk of congestive heart failure, depression, and asthma. Our job must be to expand benefits, not cut them. Our job must be to strengthen Social Security, not weaken it. Standing with the disabled. Let us not forget that Social Security is not just a retirement program. It is an insurance program that protects millions of Americans who become disabled or lose their parents at a young age. Incredibly, the only source of income for about 3 million persons with disabilities is a Social Security Disability Insurance, SSDI, benefit that averages just $35 a day. In 2015, a CDC report said a stunning 53 million Americans, one of every 5 adults in our country, has a disability. CDC Director Tom Frieden said at the time, "We're all at risk of having a disability at some point in our lifetime." yet 25 years after the historic passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act, we still have miles to go to make sure that everyone who has a disability in this country can live with dignity and respect. Today, 28.5% of disabled Americans are living in poverty. About 6 million persons with disabilities have trouble finding adequate transportation, and 500,000 have reported that they do not leave their homes because of lack of transportation. Over 2.4 million Americans with disabilities pay more than half of their limited incomes on housing, and 43% of Americans living in homeless shelters have a disability. We've got to do a lot better than that. For one thing, far too many Americans with disabilities are unable to get the Social Security disability benefits they've earned and deserve. And the average benefit that 11 million Americans who do receive SSDI get is just $1,166 a month, hardly enough to survive on. Of course, that didn't stop Republicans in Congress from trying to cut disability insurance benefit by 19% in 2015, which would have cut the average yearly benefit from $13,980 to just $11,324. Let's be clear. These are our neighbors who are unable to work because of a disability. Many of them are paralyzed. Many have had their legs amputated, and many of them woke up one day and found out that they had only a short time left to live because of a terminal illness. And the Republicans wanted to cut their already inadequate benefits by $2,656 a year. Fortunately, we won that battle. But it sickens me that we even had to wage the fight. Of course, there are many other ways we fail people with disabilities, beginning with inadequate enforcement of civil rights laws to prevent discrimination in employment, public services, and public accommodations. But we also fail to provide sufficient funding for special education in our schools, and for meaningful job training and employment opportunities for people with disabilities. And there are a host of healthcare-related issues that we must address, including the dearth of long-term home care options. Clearly, we have a long way to go in terms of being a society that values the contributions of the 53 million people in this country living with disabilities. Caring for our veterans. While serious people can have legitimate differences of opinion about when our country should go to war, there should never be a debate as to whether we fulfill the promises made to the men and women who served this country in the military. As a nation, we have a moral obligation to provide the best quality care to those who have put their lives on the line to defend us. But we often have fallen short of that obligation. What we can never forget is that the cost of war is more than the 6,800 service members who died in Iraq and Afghanistan. The cost of war is more than the hundreds of billions we spend on planes, aircraft carriers, and enormously expensive weapons systems. The cost of war includes taking care of the men and women we sent off to fight the war, including the hundreds of thousands of veterans with amputations, loss of eyesight, post-traumatic stress disorder, and traumatic brain injury. It includes caring for the spouses and children who have to rebuild their lives after the loss of a loved one. It includes veterans who are having difficulty keeping jobs in order to pay their bills, their high divorce rates, and the terrible tragedy of veterans committing suicide. The bottom line is that if we are going to send people off to battle, we must do everything we can to make them whole when they return. If we can't do that, we shouldn't be sending them into war in the first place. That's the sacred contract we have with the people who put their lives on the line to defend us. And that is why, as the former chairman and a current member of the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee, I consider it one of my highest priorities in Congress to ensure that our veterans receive the care and benefits they have earned. Amid reports of unacceptable wait times at a number of VA medical facilities, many Republicans wanted to denigrate the VA and its employees and use the very real problems in the system as an excuse to privatize VA healthcare. Many Americans don't realize this, but the VA operates the largest integrated healthcare system in the nation, treating nearly 6.5 million patients each year. And according to veteran services organizations, which represents millions of veterans, and the many veterans with whom I have spoken over the years, the quality of care provided by the VA is strong. It needs to get better, but most veterans have a high regard for the VA healthcare they receive. So instead of undermining the system, I spearheaded a bipartisan effort to pass the most comprehensive veterans legislation in decades to increase accountability within the VA and ensure that all veterans have access to timely health care. We strengthened the health system by authorizing 27 new medical facilities and by providing $5 billion to hire more doctors and nurses to care for the surging number of veterans returning from their wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. We provided incentives to attract young doctors to the VA, and we made it easier for some veterans to see private doctors or go to community health centers. We expanded VA education benefits and improved care for veterans who experienced sexual trauma while serving in the military. That is how we honor our veterans. Not by paying them lip service and shutting the VA, but by strengthening the services and the care they receive. But more work remains to be done, much more. We must improve and streamline the VA disability claims process. We must make comprehensive dental care available at all VA medical centers and expand caregiver provisions. The number of veterans battling mental health disorders continues to rise, and the number of veterans who commit suicide remains unacceptably high. Some 22 veterans take their own lives each and every day. We must make sure that all veterans have the mental health care they need. We must expand the VA caregivers program to provide home care to veterans who need intensive attention, and we must fully undo the cuts to military pensions that were insisted upon by Republicans in the last budget deal. Lastly, we must end the travesty of veterans' homelessness. While significant gains have been made over the past 6 years, the fact that on any given night, there are some 50,000 homeless veterans on the streets is a national disgrace. The sad truth is that war is an extremely expensive proposition in terms of human life, human suffering, and financial cost. Taking care of veterans is a cost of war, and it is a cost that we can no longer shirk. It's that simple. Empowering Native Americans. When we speak about people whose needs are often ignored or dismissed, we are surely speaking about the Native American community. Native Americans are the first Americans. Yet, they have for far too long been treated as third-class citizens. Time and time again, our Native American brothers and sisters have seen the federal government break solemn promises, abrogate treaties, and allow corporations to put profits ahead of the sovereign rights of tribal communities. Our treatment of Native Americans is a stain on our collective moral conscience. It is unconscionable that today, many Native Americans still do not have the right to decide some of the most important and basic issues that affect their communities. The United States must not just honor Native American treaty rights and tribal sovereignty. It must also move away from a relationship of paternalism and control and toward one of deference and support. The United States has a duty to ensure equal opportunities and justice for all of its citizens, including the 2.5 million Native Americans who share this land. It is no secret that we are shirking that duty. Native Americans face appalling levels of inequality, unemployment, poverty, and systemic injustice. 1 in 4 Native Americans are living in poverty, and the high school graduation rate is 67%, the lowest of any racial demographic group. They have a much lower life expectancy and higher uninsured rates than the population at large, and even those who have health insurance often have difficulty accessing the care they need. The second leading cause of death for Native Americans between the ages of 15 and 24 is suicide. One in three Native women will be raped in her lifetime, and most of the offenders are non-Native. The United States has greatly exacerbated the struggles of Indian country because of its failure to support basic principles of self-determination. Today, Native American land is being taken away and given to multinational corporations for mineral extraction. Native Americans are more likely to be killed by police than any other racial group, and the rate of violent crime against them is twice the national average. Yet, because the federal courts have chipped away at tribal sovereignty, tribal nations are often unable to prosecute criminal offenders for crimes that occur within tribal borders. Tribal governments must have the autonomy and authority to control their land and protect their own people. In May 2016, I visited the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, the home of the Oglala Sioux tribe, and heard from the people there. In Pine Ridge is massive poverty, incredibly high unemployment, and high levels of alcoholism and drug addiction. Over 60% of children are poor, and more than 80% of the working age population do not have a job. The schools and the healthcare system there are inadequate. Life expectancy on the reservation is just 48 years for men and 52 for women, the equivalent of that of a poor third world country. Despair is rampant with high rates of youth suicide. These statistics are not a secret. They've been known for years. But the decades come and go, and nothing happens. The misery continues. One of the promises I made during the campaign is that I would fight to make sure that the 2016 Democratic platform